The world is evolving at a faster pace than ever before, and as we begin the path to recovery after global disruption, this podcast explores how the design industries can adapt to changing expectations and create a better future for both your business and your consumers. I'm Lisa White, Creative Director at WGSN. You're listening to Create Tomorrow, the WGSN podcast. I'm here with Anab Jain and John Ardern of Superflux, a studio that creates speculative worlds and tells future stories that help explain where civilization might be going and what we might do to influence these potential outcomes. Their byline is brilliant at explaining their work in just 7 words: translating future uncertainty into present-day choices. Superflux is a living, breathing embodiment of WGSN's STEPIC outlook on trends, mixing deep research in society, technology, the environment, politics, and industry with a heavy dose of creativity. They say that fiction foreshadows the future, and if there's anything that the pandemic has taught us, it's that the future will be here sooner than we think, and we'd better prepare for it. We already know that the French military works with science fiction writers to prepare for future scenarios. Likewise, Superflux applies their research, analysis, and speculative narratives to wicked problems in government. They've worked with policymakers from the UK to the UAE. They also work closely with business, creating corporate visions that can allow brands to create more responsible, sustainable futures. They've worked with many of the world's biggest tech companies, from Microsoft to Sony, Samsung, and Nokia. Superflux are also very active in the spheres of art and design, where they build speculative scenarios that allow for direct public interaction, a sort of living consumer panel, if you will. They've exhibited in major museums like the MoMA in New York, the National Museum of China, and of course the V&A in London, where they live. Currently, they're showing not one but 2 provocative installations that question how we will live together with nature in the Venice and the Vienna Biennales, which run from May to November this year. But before we discuss their most recent work, I'd like for us to understand better how they see and work with the future. So Anab and John, thank you very much for joining us today. You know, we always feel that, the consumer emotion and human emotion is one of the most important drivers, if not the most important driver in creating change. And I think that's something that I really thought was super interesting when we saw your mitigation of shock videos and installations as well, too. That was something that was a bit like a gut punch as well, because you work so often with things that are optimistic, but it was really taking a look at something that is super pessimistic, this, you know, climate crisis. And, you know, the fact that you went and designed this flat, and the one that we took a look at was the one for London 2050. And so really with the narrator, we were put in the skin of this person as he's walking around his apartment and describing his life. And, you know, basically, you know, taking a look at just, you know, things that were happening outside with the social unrest, things that were happening inside and the social interaction that happened with people who were living in the flat. But then really dark things too, like on the bookshelf, that book, Pets is Protein. And all of a sudden we're like, oh my gosh, it really makes people think that much harder about the implications of our current lifestyles. How do you do that? How do you take something that is thorny and difficult and as terrifying as climate crisis and bring it to a realm where people can understand it and break it down and adopt it and not feel quite as threatened by it? How do you do that?
I think with that project, the main mechanism we used was to consider the point in the future that scenario was taking place, and that was a point at which our son will be roughly our age in the future. And that became this kind of emotional lens for us to look through and to really start to feel close to that future. And I think that was the kind of the entry point for us, that we could then kind of step into that world. But it was a combination of, you know, looking at the drivers and trends at a kind of high level. So speaking with climate scientists and speaking with economists and kind of understanding what are the big drivers that will affect that world. And at the same time, finding that emotional endpoint and kind of allowing those two things to meet and then to start to kind of pad it out and look at various details of how our world might change and evolve.
It's this kind of idea that there is always, there's a macro and the micro, there is data and the experience, there is the model and the artifact. We try very hard not to categorize and silo and departmentalize scenarios and ideas, but rather to find ways to weave these threads together, because that's how our life plays out. It is complex and uncertain and multifaceted, and you have to sit down and have dinner, and your child might be drawing whilst the news is saying some rather scary things. And that is this, these tensions exist all around us. And I think unless we recognize that there are no fully optimistic and no fully pessimistic worlds, we won't be really able to embody these futures that we will find ourselves in. So we try really hard to embrace the tension and to present it in a way that feels experiential and believable and relatable to people.
And you really set the stage as well. There's, even though it was a video, one had a sense of taste and touch and smell and that type of thing as well too. So you go into an enormous amount of detail. How long did it take you to get the first iteration of that project together?
It was a real labor of love. I don't know, probably about a year almost.
I would say at least a year just for the installation. And then about a year before that was a lot of prototyping and testing these food growing systems, what works, what doesn't work, because everything works in that apartment. All those food growing systems are actually growing and producing food. So this is not, it is a speculative approach. So it's set in the future, but it's real. And it's not a render in that sense of the word.
And even after that installation was made, we continued to learn and we continued to kind of readjust how we would imagine responding to that scenario.
Especially after the past year that we've lived, when one goes back and takes a look at those videos, it feels quite real. And I always say the past and the future are present. Speaking of that, in this past year, we've had so many radical shifts and, as they say, accelerations this past year. And many of these changes have been predictable. We've been speaking of the need for structural change for a long time, the systems that rule the world, from energy systems to supply chain systems and social systems and medical and educational. And do you think now, after the year that we've lived, that institutions and corporations like the ones that you worked with, the people, do you think we are now ready to make some of those long-term changes in systems that are necessary? Or do you think as soon as things really ease up, it's going to be business as usual again?
I think in some things probably won't remain businesses, just in terms of observing that, a lot of people who have the privilege of being able to work from home will continue to do so. And, people, I think this kind of some amount of mask wearing at a very fundamental level might continue. I think it would be a shame if we went back to business as usual. I think if we did not learn, and I think the biggest learning is to expect simultaneous constant uncertainty in some ways, to continue to use dated indicators of success and impact measurement. Even today, I think that to me is a bigger problem, not so much our behaviors. So we still want to put the same kind of criteria to judge a project success. We still want to hold on to the same ideas of what the future will look like, even though we've had a massive blip where a third of the world stopped completely, came to a halt for months. So I think if we can learn from this, that many such things, other kinds of things could happen. And to generally question is, are we prepared for it? What can we do? And I think for businesses at several levels, are you maintaining competition? Are you still relevant? Are you actually contributing to society? Are you going to be good ancestors? And from a very functional to a very philosophical level, these are the questions I hope organizations are considering.
I would agree. I think that two of the biggest things I hope we learn from it are that the world can radically change very quickly, and that complacency is dangerous to kind of to assume that the world will continue in the way that it has or the way that you want it to is dangerous. And I think the other big thing is that when these things do happen, they don't happen in a siloed, you know, the pandemic has radically changed our lives in ways that we would never have expected. You know, if we'd have just sat and said, okay, there's going to be a pandemic come through, we would have thought about the kind of the biological implications, maybe the potential of losing loved ones. But I don't think we would have thought about the fact that we're going to be spending hours of our life on Zoom, or the fact that shops and businesses are going to be forcibly shut down for, you know, there's all these kind of
mental health.
Yeah, yeah. The mental health problems of that, you know, just the kind of, yeah, those the wider implications and how these things just ripple out through all our systems, you know.
And this is actually really important to that point to just mention that, you know, when you do futures work, very often it's like, these are the key drivers. In technology, you have these drivers. In health, you have these drivers. In consumer society, and what we've seen is that the coronavirus didn't come along and go just stay along its health corridor. It didn't stay in its lane. It affected our economy. It affected our social life, our cultural life, our mental health. And these things are interconnected. And unless organizations working with futures and businesses who are demanding ideas around the future acknowledge that these things are interconnected, interdependent, we will not be prepared for what is to come.
I know that when you are speaking with your clients, if it's a government or if it's a corporation, they crave certainty. They want to be able to rely on it. They want to be able to say, we've got this data and we can extrapolate it and this is where we're going to go. So how have you been able to work with them to be more comfortable with uncertainty and more comfortable with a speculative future? How has that process worked for you?
Not very well. And most people really shy away from that. This kind of, it's considered risky, often even termed as all woo-woo and whimsy, just doing a few stories. And, you know, where does that land? And I think it's that sad. I think I genuinely think it's unfortunate, because if you look at the biggest economists of UK are now talking about the narrative paradigm rather than relying on probabilistic modeling, like Kay and King's new book, Radical Uncertainty. So I think it's really, really those who we have worked with are people who are ambassadors of this thing. You are champions. There are people internal inside the organizations who believe in trying and testing alternative tools to help us navigate and chart paths through uncertainty. And if we see that interest, then there's a real exciting collaboration, because what happens is that we collaborate very closely and create not only the brief and the idea, but are also able to go on a journey with the client using a plethora of different tools, you know, from speculative design, design fiction, to world building, to embodied imagining, to diegetic prototyping, to feral futuring, you name it. These kind of vast number of tools we have at our disposal to be able to truly imagine and create possible futures is very exciting. And it can really give people, as you said, in our kind of zippy one-liner, choices that they can literally step into.
And do you get feedback from them afterwards where they've taken these choices?
Yes. In some cases, so for instance, we did a project which was done for a financial investment organization, where we created a fictional company from the future, and we presented it as a real company in a finance conference with next to, you know, Standard Chartered Bank and HSBC, and we were this kind of startup business company. And we created these products, including one was a genetic calculator, where people had to come and give their saliva swabs, and they would see on this calculator what was the value of their genetic data on this new kind of stock market? So was L'Oreal looking for this genetic data for their research, or was Google Research looking for it? And it was, and we had queues of bankers who were lining up, happily giving their saliva samples to us because they wanted to know what was their value on this, what was the value of the genetic data. And there weren't even questions asked about the ethics of what we were doing with their saliva samples. That aside, the next day we did a presentation where we revealed the fact that this was a speculation. It was to show that these kind of nimble organizations that think of value in different ways apart from financial idea of value could start taking off. You all wanted to invest in us. You all wanted to test out our products. So what that did was led to a lot of different kind of seeds that were sowed in a lot of different companies and ideas. So, and we have since taken that to UNDP, and UNDP in turn started an internal lab around inclusive microfinance and thinking of finance and value in different way. So I think the knock-on effects of this work kind of gravitate across in different ways. And that's actually quite exciting because it doesn't limit us to a certain kind of audience.
And what do you feel like, you know, the speculative design process, what does that bring to a company like a bank that they can't get anywhere else?
I suppose one thing is that quite often when you present a future, it is presented as an idea in the form of a PowerPoint, or it's presented as a possible scenario. And you have the opportunity to dismiss it if it doesn't fit within your worldview. If you are presented with it as if it really exists, you are in a way confronted with it in the most banal ways sometimes. And then it challenges your ideas of what you thought was not possible because it is in front of you. And I think that jump from what could be to being within it and inside it and experiencing it is something that is, I think, really valuable, especially if you are going to make large investments in new product developments and new innovations, to be able to experiment and actually experience the consequences of that idea is can be very powerful. So I think that's what speculative design brings.
It almost gives you an object or a place to think from, whereas often reports and more data-driven models kind of tell you something you should think, and I think that's it's much more easy to maybe not dismiss, but to kind of to consume that and say, okay, that's an interesting opinion. Whereas if you give somebody the tools from which to consider something themselves and to think from that space, then somehow they're kind of closer to that understanding. And I think that understanding kind of, at least I hope, is that understanding is somewhat deeper rooted and more functional, and almost sits there as a part of their kind of process of decision making.
In your work as well too, you've been talking about the importance of diversity and the fact that the future is constantly shifting and there's diverse potentials. You know, there's so many different possibilities out there, and that hooking up the idea of, since there's diverse potentials, then things have to be approached from a diverse and inclusive point of view. And I was wondering if you could give an example of what that could look like, this diverse and inclusive point of view that you're working with.
We take the responsibility of thinking of the future quite seriously, in a sense that it comes with privilege, that it comes with the fact that we are aware that this is a point of view and that is our point of view. And we make that very explicit. Increasingly, there has been a pushback to the idea of inclusivity, saying that that means you are asking somebody who's not within the bounds of your world of view to step into yours and to include those who are not, and they may not want to be. So there's this whole kind of political conversation going on about what even does inclusive mean, or are we celebrating difference rather than making everything include so that you come into my circle and so you feel included, but hey, I don't belong in your circle, so why should I even bother? So there are these kind of tensions. But that aside, I think it would be wrong to say that the work we do includes everybody or is inclusive in any way. It opens up the possibility of the story we are telling to those who are able to access it. But by no means can we include many different points of view. You can include some. So currently we are doing a project where we are collaborating with six young people who are telling their stories and their hopes for a climate altered future. Now, I think that is inclusive in a way. We are all sharing and learning from each other. But we can be very, I think we can be very aware of things, but I wouldn't say I can include somebody's perspective who lives in Japan on climate change, because that would be hubristic, I think.
I think one thing we do is we push and we test our assumptions.
Exactly.
I think with every project we do, we try and find new perspectives. We try and arrive somewhere that's surprising to ourselves. So I think that maybe that kind of opens up.
Yes.
The worldview.
Yeah. It's opening up of, and it is asking questions quite often. We say we design questions. And so it is a question that can be considered from different angles.
And that kind of brings us to what I would say what you're doing now at the Venice Biennale, because it's going beyond, you know, diversity inclusion among humans. It's really taking a look at humans as not being the masters of the world. I guess like the one question I wanted to ask you is like, are human beings overrated?
If we asked the other species, they would say yes.
I think the wider world certainly is, from our perspective. I think we have a real tendency to consider ourselves to be at the center of everything, and kind of not acknowledge the fact that we are so deeply interconnected with the world around us and kind of nothing without it, really.
I think the idea of a more than human-centered world rather than a human-centered world is something we've been thinking a lot about, which actually came from working so closely with living systems and growing systems during mitigation of shock. It just spending so much time in this apartment and working with them, just thinking of designing systems or artifacts that are capricious in nature rather than fully fleshed, beautiful artifacts at the end, just made us think a lot more about our role in as designers and creatives or futurists or whatever you call it. And I think over and above, it is about presenting a perspective that challenges other perspectives. And I think this is about saying, what if we had a different relationship with other species on the planet? What if we considered the bees and the wolves and the lichens and the mosses as our companions? And what if we give back to them what we take from them? And how does that change the way we view the planet? And what if we move from this idea of extraction or thinking of nature as a resource to see ourselves as part of nature? We are also nature. And therefore, that shift, could it lead to a different way of viewing the world and therefore different way of quote-unquote consuming, or what lifestyles we live and how what infrastructures we build and what landscapes we terraform? I think it just is about opening up other worlds within our world, our entangled worlds.
Mm. That's such a beautiful way of responding to the theme of the Biennale, is how will we live together? And I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about Invocation for Hope.
I can just give a quick update, quick story, that in Invocation of Hope, again, based on the similar ideas of interconnectedness and interdependence with other species, both the projects are built on the same themes. With Invocation of Hope, we are salvaging and bringing 400 burned trees from a nearby wildfire destroyed forest outside of Vienna to the Museum of Applied Arts, the MARC, and presenting it as this monocultured grid forest that was grown as. And then as visitors walk through this path of these burnt trees, they arrive at the center, which is this kind of an oasis of a resurgent forest. And here you have you have the chance to really become one with the ferns and the wild grasses and the dawn chorus and the kind of reflections for the animals that you see when you look into the water. So again, a reflective experience, a contemplative experience to consider this very fragile relationship we have with the planet and to draw attention to this urgency that we have and then very little time, but rather than just keep saying, do something about it, urgent, let's do something about it. What if we started this real symbiotic relationship of love with other species and the planet? That once you love somebody, you want to do anything for that entity. And so it's like, this is something that we want to inspire through the installation, Invocation for Hope. So it is in a way an invocation for hope.
And a kind of showing the kind of the two possibilities of, you know, of the way that we can relate to the world, I guess, and value it as this diverse life sustaining and supporting thing that we are a part of, or we can kind of see it as a commodity and something to be extracted from, and hopefully laying bare the kind of the stark outcomes of or potential outcomes of those two attitudes.
I like that very poetic element where you approach the water and you look down and you can see an animal drinking from the pond on the other side, kind of your, not necessarily your spirit animal, but another animal besides yourself. And then for your other installation, which is also around hope as well too, it's, you know, you're actually creating a table and a dining table to invite other species around. So can you explain, you know, how that actually, the design of that table and then the experience that's going to be around that as well?
So yes, the idea is that it's a deconstructed home and there's a dining table and a window at the end of it, which you can view the rewilded cityscape landscape outside. And this is this majestic oak table, and it invites different species to come together as equals and dine together. So there's a human child and a human adult, woman and a man, and there's a boar and a longhorn cow and a rat and a pigeon and a snake and a wasp and a fox and mushroom and so on. Different 14 different seats at the table. So that's the kind of conceptual idea, because we want to, again, we don't expect a wolf and a human child to be dining together around the table ever. But what we are trying to say is, what happens if we think of ourselves as equal? And what happens if we come together to dine? And dining is such a, it brings cultures together. It connects humans across the world. It's such a important part of our lives. So we intentionally chose this very center of the home.
So we are kind of playing in this sort of archetypal realm in a way, and playing with the ideas of how we perceive ourselves and the natural world and relation to that. But yeah, we also wanted to embody that in a real strong physicality. So the table itself is made from an oak tree that grew naturally and died naturally in a woodland just outside of London. And it's been, so although all the wood is, it's very difficult to work with, but it's also very beautiful, the knots and the kind of, and the way the grain runs through it, and just the way we made it as well. The table was made by someone from our studio who worked with his dad in a workshop in Oxford for I don't know how long.
It's
a long, yeah. It was a labor of love. And then we have the cutlery that was made by
another colleague of ours, yeah, Nicola, in the studio. She's a really great illustrator.
Yeah, and Leanne in Orkney made the knives and forks and the various cutlery and things. So it was kind of made by
all our team.
Yeah, throughout the lockdown in these different locations, and really kind of the detail and the love that's gone into it was, you know, is kind of, I think it's evident when you see it.
Each plate has an illustration centered around the animal who's going to eat from it, but also together tells the story of this resurgent world, which has gone from almost being destroyed by climate crisis to a renewal and a regeneration. Same with all the seeds. Each seed represents the different species. Each piece of cutlery represents how we think they might like to eat. And of course, the food offerings are just like honey or oak or acorn or, you know, whatever that eats. Of course, this has all been designed by humans. So we assume that there are going to be species who want to come around and eat from plates and have cutlery. And we agree, that's completely a human perspective. Mm. But we intentionally kept that human perspective in to be able to carry people into that, into this, what is almost like a mythic folklore, to be able to bring people to have something that they feel they can connect to. So that's the experience. People can identify with a set, well laid out dining table. But then again, like mitigation of shock, where you see pets as protein, you find a stool that has been gnawed over by a beaver, or you find the pigeon poo on the thing, or you find this snake skin, or, you know, so then
there are these little details and little hints of humor here and there, but it's also framed by a poem that you hear recited over the thing. And the poem is almost like a non-religious prayer that's kind of talking about this change in relationship and the potential that might bring.
And both of these projects and your work in general speak so much about hope, and you use the word hope a lot. And you know, after all this year that we've gone through, and the word hope, I'm American originally, and so Joe Biden's talking about hope and hope all over the place, and it's sometimes it's a little bit hard to believe when it comes out of the mouth of politicians. So how do you always go back into the well of what you're doing creatively and intellectually to be able to stand behind hope, to be able to say that there is hope despite, you know, all of these very negative things that have happened and could possibly happen? Where does your hope come from, and how do you believe in it?
I mean, I would probably start by saying that we often say there are kind of two forms of hope. There's the kind of passive hope where you sit back and you say, well, maybe things will be better tomorrow. And then there's the more active form where you see a possibility, and you know, because you see that possibility, there is that potential, and because you know that it's possible, you're kind of it's your responsibility to pursue it. So even though we see there is the potential for disaster, I think that there is that possibility for hope. And I think that even things like the pandemic, you can see how quickly the world can change, and if it can change so quickly into such a problematic scenario, I think that it can also change, you know, that there are, I think, you know, love is also contagious. You know, there have been periods in history where, you know, where society has radically changed for the better. So I think it's seeing that perspective and seeing the fact that, you know, there have been times in history when, you know, warlike nations have suddenly switched to nations of philosophers. So I guess it's that, it's seeing that, you know, as well as things being able to fall apart, they can also come together.
And I guess my last question, what is one of the most rewarding ways that you've seen your work change a situation, if not the world?
So we get quite a lot of like young people who are attempting to make sense of the world, write to us saying, we find your work really inspiring and we want to think in these ways. So we get a lot of that kind of stuff, which is always rewarding, you know. There have been very kind of direct things where you see some influence. You might have some small influence in changing the energy strategy of a country at scale. There are a lot more sort of hard to point on things around critical thinking or around critical imagination that have rippled across through other practices, through other people's works, through writing, through works of activists. So I think it's a bit of an immeasurable sense of change, but the work we do is immeasurable in so many ways. There is no direct indicator to it. But I think what would be fair to say is that we are on a journey of some form of what we call slow activism. And this is some kind of where we are trying to explore what it would mean if we all as a society asked more questions, if we really questioned and critically thought about the decisions we're making. So I suppose we're just trying to make a dent there.
Thank you to Anab and John for taking the time to speak to us today. If you're a WGSN subscriber, you'll find reports covering many of the issues we touched upon, including our future innovations reports, our design features co-design report, and our speculative design report, where we explore how speculative design is being used in increasingly commercial settings to help forge new business models, strategies, and products, while balancing the traditional requirements of a company. You can subscribe to the show on all major podcast platforms, and if you like what you've heard, why not leave us a rating and a review on iTunes? For more insight and analysis on global trends, head over to WGSN.com to discover how you can get access to our service. We're constantly publishing new content focusing on how we can design a brighter, better future for our industries, from food and drink, lifestyle and interiors, to beauty and fashion. I'd also like to thank our podcast producer, Roland Bodenham. We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. So until then, stay well and healthy, and we'll see you next time.